Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I am your host, Dr. JC. The inaugural season of Next Us 818 Podcast focuses on the 6888 Central Postal Directorate Battalion. The 6888 was a unique U.S. Army unit which had the distinction of being the only all-African-American, all-female battalion to serve in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. In most episodes, I have interviewed 6888 descendants. In episode 8, we will talk about the 2019 documentary, The 6888. My guest tonight is James Thayers, executive producer, director, and writer of the 6888 documentary. Welcome, Jim.
Hey, hello, everyone.
I'd like to start with a few interesting facts. You're an award-winning filmmaker. Your first documentary, The 30th of May, received the Dr. Margaret Walker Alexander Award at the 10th Annual Creative Arts Festival, as well as 25 other awards. The Hello Girls, your second documentary, won Best Documentary Feature at the Chagrin Documentary Film Festival in 2018. It also won the People's Choice Award at the Beloit International Film Festival in 2019. And your third documentary, The 6888, was nominated for Best Documentary Feature at the 9th Annual Charlotte Black Film Festival. Very impressive body of work, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. They're all about veterans.
We're going to talk a lot about that. Before we discuss the 6888 documentary, tell me about the first two films, The 30th of May and Hello Girls. What are the storylines?
The 30th of May came out of my graduate paper when I was studying at Jackson State for master's in history. And so I stumbled across this story that no one had ever heard about. And it's an African-American tradition, Memorial Day tradition, that dates back all the way to 1866. So folks in the region of Vidalia, Louisiana, and Natchez, Mississippi, primarily, have come together for what, 15, 16 decades now, and celebrated Black military service to the country over the Memorial Day weekend. And the crowning, the flagship of that whole weekend, because it's a weekend of events, the flagship is a 5-mile march that starts in Vidalia, Louisiana, at a small church on the Louisiana side of the Mississippi River. Folks march over the Mississippi River Bridge and then stop at the Natchez Mississippi Welcome Center. And then they continue the march basically uphill the rest of the way to the National Cemetery that sits on the bluff overlooking the Mississippi River. So folks have been doing that since they've been doing that since 1889. They've been getting together and celebrating freedom first and then Memorial Day second as that transitioned into that day for folks in that region. Now, what's interesting, and it's called the 30th of May because that's what the folks in the region still refer to it as. And if you look at when you look at the documentary, you'll see even young folks wearing T-shirts that say the 30th of May on it. So that's how that community has identified with Memorial Day tradition in America, and particularly a Black Memorial Day tradition in the Deep South now. For the longest time, and still are in many ways, they were the lone voice of Union victory. They would march right down Main Street, whatever year it was, in their World War I uniforms, Spanish-American, Civil War uniforms. And due to this day, it's probably the longest-running tradition, Memorial Day tradition consecutively, based on my research, in the country. How about that?
It's so amazing to learn about this because even though I grew up in the Deep South, I'd never heard of this before.
Right. You should have seen the look on all my professors' faces who were born and raised and were Jackson State professors. And they were like, Jim, how can I be teaching here for 30 years and not know? And then friends that I got a friend from Natchez that said, a Black friend, a military guy, said, how did I not know about this? I'm like, dude, how did you not? The folks, they go right down Main Street. You can't miss them. You know, 500, 600 people. And it's there's a lot of style and pizzazz to it. You know, think of New Orleans style tradition with the marching bands and the dancers. It is so cool to watch them do that. And then when they get to the National Cemetery, there's a more traditional Memorial Day, you know, program. Speakers. I spoke at 2016, which was the 150th anniversary, which is the one I filmed as well. Because it happened to fall on May 30th, 2016. But yeah, there's such, and I didn't even tap into the smaller traditions. Like you can see it in the documentary, but there's a specific way the leadership walks into the cemetery. It's almost military style. The front row, which includes men and women, they walk in step all the way up to the pavilion, and then the band and everything is on the side. It is so full and rich, Black interpretation, African American interpretation of Memorial Day, that it's amazing. It's amazing, you know, that folks, they just refuse to let it die, which
Well,
is also amazing.
sounds like something I need to calendar.
You need to calendar that. Last year, I was looking at. I know I intend to go next year. I haven't been in. They asked me to come last year. What's very interesting is Dr. JC, is that okay?
It's okay.
Okay. What's very interesting, Dr. JC, is that women in that region play a critical role, very similar to the role of the American Legion auxiliaries, the VFW auxiliaries, and those auxiliaries. The women there in 1898 launched an organization. Well, it had already been launched, but they launched a chapter of the Women's Relief Corps post 590. That's still there. That building is still there. And when I went to do some filming, they gave me access to that building. It's just a very small, think of a shotgun shack with pews in it, you know, very traditional old style South. And on the wall was hanging the original charter of the Women's Relief Corps, dated June something, 1889, with the signatures of the women on there. And I remember telling the vice president of the current Women's Relief Corps, her name will come to me in a minute. I can picture her. I said, ma'am, you know, this document is an incredible piece of history. And I know you don't want to lose it, but my goodness, the Mississippi River is so close. You know, I mean, that where that house is, there's huge berms that protect the Mississippi River from coming over, flowing into Vidalia. But that we know that that may not always work either. So when I go back, one of the things I want to try to do is see if they're, because this could easily be on display, like at the any African American museum somewhere. I'm thinking DC even, because I think that this post might be the only post of the Women's Relief Corps in the South. Now, there are some in the North. It's more of a Northern thing. But you know, after the Civil War, there were Union troops down there. So these things, and then after they left, the USCT troops still had a proud heritage that they wanted to share. And so that's how some of these popped up. Many of them died out. And I certainly believe it's the only African American female women's relief corps in the country. There's another one for you. And in fact, I read last year that the president of the women's relief corps, a white female out of the North somewhere, who manages all these, she didn't know anything about these women and what they were doing in the Deep South. And she attended the event last year. I read, yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm telling you, it's, you know, it's it it it's a, the women all, I forgot, I didn't send you the link. I'm going to. The women all, you know, the men all dress in their military, some dress in military, some civilian, but others, you know, in their American Legion with their tie and this and that. And the women all dress in white dresses.
So
And they
many
look just, yeah, I'm sorry.
I was so many untold stories. It's important to get these out, and your film is a important body of work to tell the story.
Thank you. It's magnificent. It's magnificent. what's been happening down there under the radar. You know, just in that region, it'll get newspaper coverage, occasional TV coverage, but it certainly hasn't gone beyond anything regional. And you know, in some way, shape, or form, I think in part, some of the people there, they like it that way. You know, they like it that way. I do remember when I was doing the project, writing the paper, doing the film. I met with, and you'll see him in the film. He has since passed. He was 92 at the time, World War II veteran Frank Williams. And I had joked around with him that I worked right across the street from the White House, and this is when President Obama, of course, was still in the office. And I said, "Mr. Frank, now I can't promise you anything, but you know, I work right." I was just kidding, really. I work right across from the White House. What if we can get the president to come down on his last time for your 150th? And you know what he told me with all sincerity too. He said, "Well, he's going to have to start in the back like everybody else. Every other new person does." You know, this is a 92-year-old guy, Dr. JC. He's been doing this. He's on record talking about when he was a little boy watching this in the 1930s. He's been doing this for 70 years and has been the leader of it for 40. His way, I mean, but respectfully, but here's the funny thing he did say. He said, "Unless Michelle comes, and then she can walk up here with me." How about that? 92 years old. He's no dummy. Put the husband in the back and bring the wife.
Barack knows.
Barack knows too. He sure does.
So tell me about the Hello Girls.
After I'd done that film, and you know, it just really kind of blew up from my perspective. I never expected to win awards. I never expected to be on Mississippi Public Television, anything. And then when it did, I was like, "Well, that's kind of cool, you know." And I got a history background. I kind of know how to do it. So I was Googling, and I like to do things timely about veterans, you know, based on historical dates. And I realized that you know, the end of World War I was coming up. So I was doing some Google search. And this book by Elizabeth Cobbs, a Stanford professor, came up called The Hello Girls. And I was like, "Huh, what is this?" And so I was in DC at the time again. And I got to her author's page, and I sent her an email, and I said, "Hey, I'm very interested in your book. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'd like to pursue a documentary about it." And she called me back. She called me back same day, said, "I'll be in DC in July," and this would have been 2018. "I'll be there in July 2018. We can do my part at a friend of mine's house." And so one thing led to another, and we put all these pieces together, and we did this story about World War I women, very similar to the 6888. These women went overseas as signal corps telephone operators, so they were telephone operators. They wore uniforms. They swore army oaths. They worked on the front lines. They participated in battle rhythm type stuff. Well, then when the war was over, these were the first of their kind. Now, the women who had joined the Navy in World War I, they were given benefits because of what the Navy regulations said, that any person could serve. Well, the Army regulations said any man, and man and male was peppered throughout the document. And so when it came time to get veterans benefits, they denied them. And they had to fight for 60 years to get their veteran benefits. Many of them came back with tuberculosis. Like the 6888, two of them died overseas, most likely from the Spanish flu. One is still buried there at Suresnes National Cemetery in Paris. She died on November 11th, 1918, the day the armistice was signed. And like the 6888, with their 17 million pieces of mail in that time, the Hello Girls and the Signal Corps connected over 26 million calls during their 6 months in the battlefield, and then also later on at the Paris Peace Conference. So yeah, their contribution to World War I was pretty significant as well. So yeah, I stumbled across that. Google, thank goodness for Google, right, Dr. JC? Oh my gosh.
It's a conduit.
It is.
It's a conduit. So
Never would have been it. Yeah.
it's not the
If I
same.
had to do all this traditional research, go to place it, never would have got it done.
So let's talk about the making of the 6888 film.
Yep.
You have extensive knowledge about women's service and contributions to the United States military. Where did the idea for this compelling story come from, and why do you think it's so important to tell the story?
This is my favorite story of why I made the 6888. So I was traveling with the Hello Girls in 2018. It was early in 2018. We had just screened at the Women's Museum, and the military was in where we were all at last June, July. So I was traveling. I was in Arizona, and I was at the Q&A. Lady comes up to me and said, "Hey, have you ever heard of these black women from World War II?" And I said, "No, I hadn't." But I gotta admit, people are always coming up to me, "Hey, I got this great story for you, right?" And a lot of, 9 times out of 10, it's like, okay, it might be a great family story, but it's not a broader story. So I kind of put it in my brain. And then I was in Kansas City at the World War I Museum screening the Hello Girls around May, sometime in May. Lady came up to me again, kind of asked me the same question. I said, well, that's very interesting. I didn't do any research yet. And then the third time I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, my hometown, well, my home state. I'm from Racine, just to the south. And I was screening at the War Memorial Museum there. And the Hello Girls, a lady comes up to me, says the same thing. And she says, "Oh, and by the way, one of the women, Anna Mae Robertson, lives here in Milwaukee." And I said, "Okay, God, how many times are you going to tell me
Three
you
times,
need to
right?
do this? I mean, how many times am I going to clobber you over the head with this? No one's done this. Why don't you do this story?" So that's when I started my research, probably summer of 2018. The first person I found was a gentleman at the Chickamauga battlefield over at Fort Oglethorpe, where the women trained, who for years has been doing PowerPoints when people, and he talks about the women training there. And then he connected me to Carlton Philpott, who connected me to Edna Cummings, who connected me to Liz, and they, all of them, connected me to all these different women and family members. And it was a lot easier than one would think, because people wanted to tell their story. And then all the archival footage, when I found all of that, I was like, wow, this is a gold mine, and nobody knows this story. And now everybody knows this story, in part because of the documentary, I think. And I think your second part of the question was, why is this so important? I think of the wars and the things that we fight for. I think this is making sure that these stories are told are part of what we fight for, right? I mean, when people try to take our culture, our history, which has happened in this country to a huge segment of Americans, when people steal people's culture and history, they steal everything, language, everything. And so, this story took 75 years and to finally, come to the forefront. And then once it did, we realized that everyone loves it. Everyone loves these women. But I think timing is everything too, as well. Had this story been more prominent 40 years ago, maybe, I think it would have been lost, to be honest with you, because we were still telling stories of all the other Americans. And these women, these thousand or almost 1,000 women, might have been lost to history because a book was written, as in the 80s, and that did some things, and then Charity wrote her book, and that did some things. But I think the timing was right. And part of the timing is this, is that it's important for people like yourself and like others, like family members and just other African Americans across the spectrum of the country, to be in position so that when this story comes out, that there's interest and there's willingness, to be in position to want to share it. And I think that was a big part of it, is that, I think you ultimately, people tell stories about people that look like themselves, or in my case, have similar experiences as veterans. The timing, you know, it's sad that most of the women, I think six are still left alive. It's sad that most of the women missed, you know, this recognition. But at the same time, they are in the history books now, Dr. JC. They're not officially there. I haven't seen a photo of the 6888 in a middle school history book yet, but you know what? It's gonna happen.
If they don't get
It's
canceled like everything else is getting canceled these days.
Ah, right. Yeah. I you know, I yeah, yeah. I yeah, these yeah, I hear you.
I see that Tyler Perry is also doing a documentary.
He's doing
A mini
a
series,
film.
a
Yeah,
film,
no, I
yeah.
think he's actually doing a film. Yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he tweeted that today.
Oh, he did.
Yes.
What does it say?
He just announced that he was filming. He's doing
Oh.
a Netflix film, so that will certainly get the attention of younger folks. Yeah. So
Yeah. Did he say the name by chance? I guess I don't know.
he's used the 6888.
Oh, did he? Did he? I was
So.
Yeah, so it's interesting that I think a big part of the story is going to be based on one woman, is what I think. Lena King is the one out of Vegas, still alive out of Vegas. I think her story is kind of the spine of it, as I
Right.
understand it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And of course, for our audience, we want people to know that Blair Underwood has a Broadway production coming, musical coming in about a year.
Yeah.
So should be on the lookout for that. I mean, how long did it take you to research and make this film?
So I made the 30th of May in 6 months, the Hello Girls in 8 months, and the 6888 in 8 months. So yeah, when I sit down to do it, I do it. Because if it sits, I'll lose interest, and you know, then you just you, especially when you're dealing with when you have to travel, and certainly when you're dealing with elderly people that you want to interview,
Right, you want to make sure they're still here.
you got to be timely for sure. It
So
definitely had to be timely.
you mentioned travel. I understand that the documentary is filmed in several locations in England, Scotland, and the US.
Yeah.
Tell me about the logistics of the filming and site selections.
We knew we didn't do any filming in France. We had I because I because I we didn't know much about France at the time. We're learning more, but I had enough about France from the archival interviews and what some of the women had said, because I wanted to tell the Birmingham story. I wanted to tell particularly about the male operations and what happened there. And then the Birmingham or the France piece, I wanted to talk more about what the women did during their downtime. You know, they played, as you know, played softball, and they played sports. They went to perfume. They talked to going to perfume houses, taking jujitsu. So I had all of that for France. But in Birmingham, I wanted to dive deeper, and I found a guy over there that as he's in the documentary, he talks about he's well versed about the women, and he talks about what they did in Birmingham, and he took me to the building where they worked, and we went to different places throughout the city. We went to where they marched, and we looked at that right downtown. So yeah, I had found him. And then I reached out to him, and I was thinking about this for you too. I reached out to him. I said, "Hey, do you have any, you know, any videographers that can, you know, shoot some?" And he said, "Yeah, you have two people." So yeah, so I hired them. I hired them. We shot everything, I think, in a day.
Okay.
Yeah, we shot everything in a day. So, and we just went from location to location and shot it up. Yeah, it was fun.
So, did you film in Scotland also?
We did not film in Scotland, no. I was recently in Scotland to screen, but we didn't film there, no.
Okay. So, what were the key challenges of this documentary?
I think one of the key challenges that you got to be cognizant of, for me anyways, you know, being history first, filmmaking second, is that you do everything you can to make sure you get it right, especially a story like this. And you know, this is always you know anybody that Hollywood that makes a movie, especially, you know, this is how it goes into the history book, so you hope to God that it's right, you know. And so, but documentaries are a little bit different, and you have the opportunity to get it right. That was the first thing. The second thing is that I'm glad that I had just enough brains to bring on Edna and Liz. It was important, definitely important as we went along, that their voices as retired Black female Army members, soldiers, right? That they had some specific recommendations and suggestions that I would not have probably discovered on my own. So it was very important. That was an early challenge. It would have been a bigger challenge for the film had I not had them on board. And then the rest is just, you know, logistics. I do all the interviews. I do all of the supervisory editing. So I kind of know where everything is and who said what. I do all that type of research. I just don't push the buttons. I hire someone else to push the buttons and make it. Yeah. So those are. And then, of course, financially, you know, I fund it myself, which on one end, you know, gives you the freedom that you're not beholden to anyone else. But then on the other hand, you're limited. You can be limited by budget.
Right.
You know.
Right. I'm gonna share several names. Indiana Hunt Martin, Lena King, Dolores Ruddock, Fanny Griffin McClendon, Elizabeth Barker Johnson, and Annie Mae Robinson.
Yeah.
So at the time of your filming, those were the six known living 6888 soldiers. So
yes.
You had an opportunity to interview them for the documentary. Talk about that experience for you personally.
My goodness. Well, one thing that I came away with about all six of the women I personally met was they had three qualities that I admired beyond belief. Dignity, humility, and grace. All six of them had those three. And it's almost like they all three had the same amount of drops, you know, in each one because they were so similar. I also, at their age, one thing I noticed about all of them is they all had a wonderful sense of humor. Boy, they just loved to laugh, you know, and you can see it in some of the, you know, Indiana Hunt interview, Dolores Ruddock's interview. You can see that. And so, you know, you sit down when you sit down initially with someone like that, when someone that you're interviewing that is such an impact on history and you know what you're trying to do, you know, your business, you sit down in business, you want to make sure they feel comfortable talking to you, because if they don't, and let's cut right through this. There is a hurdle for me as well as a white male, right? I have to, Edna and Liz oftentimes were that conduit, you know, basically saying, hey, don't worry, he's all right. You know, I mean, that's just the reality. I mean, it's not anything that, I mean, you know, when you look back at history and you know, all the things that have been stolen by white Americans from Black Americans from a long history, you know, you understand that there's a reluctance to open up. But those were some of the biggest hurdles, was to make folks feel comfortable. And Edna and Liz helped me get in the door on that. Once we got there, then things went smoothly. I think people all felt pretty good about the direction we were going.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to listen to those women tell the stories. So, as you know, I've been interviewing 6888 descendants, and one of the things that I found is that some of the 6888 soldiers did not talk about their service when they returned. And even in the documentary, there was a comment about that. Do you have any sense as to why some of the women chose not to discuss their service until they really were much older? Some of them didn't even tell their children when they were growing up about their service.
Yeah. I think as much that's oftentimes a personal choice with veterans. You know, as a veteran myself, I don't talk about it all that much. Persian Gulf War. You kind of talk about things like that until you get older with people that have had similar and shared experiences. You know, I know the ladies for a while, up through the 80s anyways, maybe into the 90s, would get together from time to time in groups and have annual get-togethers. And probably share a lot of stories of what they've done in their lives, but I think at some point in time, you almost come to this conclusion: okay, that this is one part of my life, something that I did when I was young. I enjoyed it. I loved it. I'm glad I did it, And even some of the women say to this day, when they talk about it, they don't know what the big deal is. But it's a big deal. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And I think there's, yeah, some are appreciating that now. And I'm happy. I'm glad that they are. At least some are here to see it, you know.
Yes, and my mother would have been joyful. She talked about it time, and she also did attend a lot of the was it NABVET, the National Association of Black
Yeah.
Women events all around the country. So she was very engaged. What was the most important lesson you learned from this film?
Yeah. You know, I'm constantly evolving on that.
Well, you don't have to pick one lesson. You could pick a couple if you'd
Yeah.
like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like every like the I think the first lesson is that you when you to try to live my life in the same way that I go into a film like this is just to keep an open mind and an open heart and find what you find and then be, enjoy what you find and do something positive with it. So that was one thing that I've the women have been for me for 5 years now have been an inspiration. You know, I mean, even watching them march, I can, at the end of the film, I can barely get through that still to this day without tearing up, because they just look so majestic. You know, they look like perfect toy soldiers, if you will. You know, I mean, they march so perfectly in dresses and shoes, and it's just crazy. And so, you think about, and then, being in the military, I think about my own experience, and I think about particularly watching the mail operations during the Persian Gulf War going from a room to Air Force hangars, just like it did for them. And so when I started making this film, I said to myself, hey, I remember that. I specifically remember all these pieces of mail that sometimes I even went back in a helicopter once to get our mail and bring it forward. So I understood their mission very well. And then I think, I heard, and I'm glad it's happening this way. And I'm going to say this. I didn't say this. Tiffany Haddish, the comedian, said this. And this is, she said this early on, maybe a year. I heard her say this a year or two after I had made the film. She said, I don't want to do and or see any more slavery movies. We've got it. We've got it. We understand it. What I want to see are uplifting movies about Black women. That's what she said. And I was like, oh, Tiffany, do I got a story for you? We never got in touch with her, but that current was running through early on, 3 years ago, that women were just playing more and more of a role every day, that Black women were playing more and more of a role every day. We heard about it in Georgia, right?
Absolutely.
How many elections have Black women won in Georgia now? I mean, Warnock has been in four, he's won four, and that's who he can thank.
Absolutely.
That's who he can thank. And so I think this film ties into just a whole different movement of men in general looking at women, Black women in particular, in a totally different light. Since the 6888 was made, or during that time, we've already talked about her. We've had Michelle Obama as the first lady of the country for 8 years. We've got the vice president. Her name's slipping, Dr. J. Help me out real quick.
Kamala Harris.
Yeah, how can I forget? But we got a vice president. You know what I'm saying? And so, and then with
Supreme
the
Court
increase,
Justice.
Supreme Court Justice Ketanji, is it Ketanji, right? I
Yes.
mean, look. So that question, that question. People say, why are these, the 6888 women are important? Well, you know what? The three people we just named are part of the three people. Maybe not in the military lane, but certainly. Our women in the 6888, your mother, were glass ceiling breakers. And I think that's what I admire the most, is that they did that. They did that. They came home and they went to school, became doctors and lawyers, and their children did. And so, yeah, their impact on American culture and society now is in the millions. When they weren't all as well known, they were impacting their communities one person, one family at a time. And I admire that. They're just such a source of inspiration. I often say to myself, where did these 855 women really come from? Right? Because they don't seem like they're really from this planet. They're too kind. They're too kind. They're too majestic. They're too graceful. I mean, what are they? Are they really real? I say that to myself sometimes. And yes, they are, right? As you know.
Yes,
Yes, they
absolutely.
are.
So let's segue and talk about you and your educational background and career. You are an award-winning public affairs officer and speechwriter for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and you've received 10 national awards for speech writing, feature writing, and event planning and media affairs. And of course, as we know, you're an award-winning independent filmmaker. Tell me about your educational background and career with the Veterans Administration.
Okay. I have an undergrad at the University of Wisconsin in history, BA in history. And from there I went into the military, spent 8 years in the military, and then spent another almost 13, maybe 10, 13 in the newspaper business, which I thought was a really wonderful business to be in after the military, because it was one of the things the military protects is the freedom of speech and newspapers and media and all that type of thing. But when the wars came in the 2000s, right in the mid 2000s, I just didn't think that I was doing enough for the country, and so that's when I joined the VA in 2009. In between that time, from 2003 to 2009, I got an MBA at a university. I won't name it because I'm going to say something bad about the degree itself. Biggest waste of time in my life. Doesn't even pay. MBAs don't even, MBAs, I don't know, unless you go from Stanford or Harvard, don't seem to carry the same weight anymore. I found that out. So then I joined the VA 2009. I started up in Tomah, Wisconsin, a little small VA medical center up north in Wisconsin. And then I went to Jackson, Mississippi, at the GV Sonny Montgomery VA Medical Center there in Jackson. And I'll tell you, Dr. J, that's where my life changed. My whole life's trajectory changed when I hit the ground in Mississippi. First thing I did when I took the job in Mississippi, the honest truth, I Googled alligators. I just said, are these things walking up and down the street down there? What is going on? Right? What is going on? So then I got down there, and I had, like I said, I had an MBA, and this is going to sound bad, and I don't mean it to sound bad. I mean it just in the opposite way to show you how remarkable my colleagues were at the Jackson VA. When I went down there with my MBA, I thought, well, shoot, I got an MBA. I might be the smartest guy here, right? Typical, right? White guy, right? Typical. Man, Dr. J, I went down there. And everybody I knew, whether it's administration or healthcare field itself, had a master's degree, doctor's degree, secretaries getting ready to use a Deion Sanders term, secretaries getting ready to elevate, right? Secretaries getting ready to elevate with a master's degree in human resources from Jackson State. That was everybody I met. So that was a huge, huge eye opener for me, just to humble me. That was a big part of Mississippi, was to humble me. And then the same thing with Jackson State. Best education I ever got. I think there were some technical, not technical, some real deliver way that they deliver HBCUs deliver the history. What I found is that no matter where you are, you're going to get social and cultural history at HBCU. You're not going to walk away from Jackson State and not know that Medgar Evers used to had an office there on right there on Jackson State campus. That James Meredith, that the COFO Center, which has been redone, Dr. King, Fannie Lou Hamer, all the greats, Stokely Carmichael, were all there on Jackson State campus. So when you're in the history department, of course, you expect that, right? But you get more other cultural and social history in a history course. Even if you're talking World War II, the books you're going to read are going to be about the social and cultural history of America. And then the lectures and the movies, the films would be about, the timeline of the war. I thought that was fascinating. It was like getting 2 degrees at once, you know? It was like getting a It was like getting a social and cultural history degree and like a political military history degree all in one from Jack. And so that's what just opened my eyes to so much down there, and to go to Jackson State and to just stumble and then change my life. I mean, because of Jackson State, I get into filmmaking. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. I mean, I remember I told a friend maybe 15 years ago, if I could do it all over again, I'd like to do filmmaking. He said, "You still can." I said, "No, I think it's past me. God brings me down to Jackson, Mississippi. I go to Jackson State, and guess what? I've made 3 films since 2016."
So your degree in Jackson State was in history,
History. Yep.
and you ended up being an independent filmmaker.
Yep.
That's an incredible story.
The funny thing is too is that I think the history part is what's because the other technical stuff, like the camera people, as we talked earlier, I can hire those out and I can tell them this is what I want. This is the shot I want. I want you to come in tight here, this and that. I can do all that and tell them it as a director. But I think the reason I'm able to make the film so quickly is because of my history training, in that, my history training will allow me, I think, has allowed me to find and get to where I want to get to much quicker. I don't have to, I don't feel any, having done this with books and papers and all that type of stuff that you write, as a director making a film, I felt okay with leaving stuff on the cutting room floor because I knew you just can't have everything. So yeah, that whole history degree pointed me in this direction.
I was going to ask you what inspired you to enter the world of documentary filmmaking, but it's history that
Yeah.
led you in that direction.
Yep, it was history. It was history and finding this story about the 30th of May, realizing how much of an impact it can have on people because the impact that I saw it had there. And it added to the fact that these unknown stories that are stuck in the nooks and crannies of history, deserve to be told. Women, some many generations of men have had difficulty agreeing to this, but since the founding of the country and before, women have played a significant role in every generation in this country. It just finally we're getting to the point now where there's enough, women, as I mentioned earlier, in leadership roles, in roles of significance in education, in every field, that these stories easily resonate because there's people like you who know somebody, right? You know somebody of the 6888. And so that's why that story became so important, because people knew somebody, and people, when they found out that these women, they just loved them. So yeah, that's how it all started. It was just it really was nothing I was going to pursue that I thought had passed me by.
It's never too late.
Never too late.
Right.
That's
So
what, yeah, that's a big lesson.
documentary filmmaking is a special genre of film because everyone has a unique story or journey, as we acknowledged. What advice would you give an aspiring documentary filmmaker, other than it's not too late?
Yeah, that's a good one. It's not too late for sure. The other one is that I think documentary filmmakers find are always looking, like me, looking for that next story that no one's heard about. So as a documentary filmmaker just coming in, know that now I think the genre has changed a lot in the last 5 years since I've been making films, is that independent filmmakers can make really good films. They really can. And you don't have to break the bank to do it, especially these young folks that are learning, the software to edit films, and they can edit and they can shoot and they can do that, do all of it. I mean, they really can be a one man band, a one person band. The other thing is too is learn, you can learn about your money. If you can figure out a way to finance it yourself, I say do that. And it's not crazy expensive. I'll even throw some numbers out there. All three, and there's been more expenses because of travel and this and that. But actual making of all three of my films, each was less than $10,000. Now, you add travel and film festivals and things like that, ups the ante a little bit. But it can be done. And I think the other piece is try to be, try to find the way that you want to tell your story, and then do it that way. So like people always told me, well, now what you need to do is get into reenactments. No, I'm not. I don't do that. One, your expenses are going to go up, but two, I always figured that there's still a medium out there where people just like to see historic people talk. And why would I want to reenact, something from Indiana Hunt Martin when you can look at her
Right,
and you
right.
can listen to her and she can tell you that, do I really need to do a scene where the Germans give the women a lot of junk, or is it even more impactful when Indiana Hunt Martin holds up this bag of stuff and says, the Germans gave us a lot of junk? Right? How impactful is that? Coming right from her directly. So yeah, so my model, my style is more of a Ken Burns style. I use the slow moving pictures. I use archival interviews and video footage, and I try to change it up emotionally. I try to follow the timelines closely because I don't want people, to walk away and not have a concept of maybe what the timeline is. I mean, France doesn't happen before Birmingham. That's important.
So it
And
sounds like
so,
editing is really important.
yeah, editing's a big deal. It really is every, making sure that when you get on the set, that everything's set, the sound's set, everything's ready to go. And then once you get all that footage, yeah, sitting down and like, whew, now you got to edit. Now, I don't write things down. As I'm going through and as I'm learning the story, it comes to me how I want to tell it, who I want to go next, who said what. Maybe even if I need something from a woman that I whose background was in a particular place, like Elizabeth Barker Johnson remembers standing in front of the Joan of Arc monument, and I knew I wanted to tell that story because of that famous photo of the women marching past the monument. And I knew I wanted her to talk about it, and she did. She did a great job, talked about, seeing that monument and that day, and so yeah, it can be done. It all can be done. It's never been an easier time, and it'll get easier to be an independent filmmaker. You can make really good the software out there today. Heck, you can shoot on iPhones. You
Right.
can get great video on iPhone. I've used iPhone video for a different project, but yeah, there's technology is your friend. Google is your friend, my budding filmmakers out there. It really is. And tell your story. Tell that story. Tell a heck of the other thing I would say too, and I always say I don't make a film to time, but having said that, be cognizant of the length of your films. And I'll tell you why. If you're going to make a 30-minute, so when you go to film festivals, there's different categories. Documentary shorts are normally 30 minutes or less, and then documentary features are normally 40 minutes or more. Yeah, there's that limbo in there. That's why time is important. There's that 10-minute limbo in there that if you want to get to one category, you got to cut. You got to want to get to another category, you got to add more. But if you're going to make a 30-minute film, then make a tw then I say make a 26-minute film. And I'll tell you why. Because you just might end up like 30th of May did. You just might end up on public television. And they're going to want that time to sell advertising.
Right.
And so if you're going to make a 30-minute documentary short, make it 26 so it'll fit into a 30-minute format on television. And the other thing is too, same thing with film festivals. You know, they have normally 4-hour blocks that they, you know, try to theme. And then within those 4-hour blocks are 1-hour blocks. Well, a 30-minute film is easier to slot than a 43-minute film. Because now you got to find a 15-minute film that's going to bring you up to 1 hour, you know? And then you got the next block, a next hour block. So, same thing with a feature, a full-length film, which is normally over 40 minutes. The Hello Girls is 56 minutes. And that was deliberate. Deliberately, what I learned from the 30th of May was to give yourself some time there. So, like a film festival would say, oh, it's 56 minutes, but we can plug that right in. Plug that right into an hour, we ain't got to worry about it. Now, the one issue with that I have on time with the 6888 is it's 73 minutes long. And so I know that there are festivals that are just going to hesitate taking a 73-minute feature because now they've got, you know, another 45 minutes to fill. And if it's along the same type of theme, it could be tough. So yeah, those would be some piece of advice as well. Don't make it to time, but if time is, you know, if you're right, if it's gonna be 31, we'll make it 28 or 26, right? You can do that. Although 4 minutes to cut is a lot. So yeah, those are some things I think that I've learned about the marketing piece. Social media, I don't do much of it, but Edna does, and that has driven a lot of traffic. So you got to have that marketing piece too, you know?
So I'm sure that the audience would be interested in viewing this documentary and probably all of your documentaries. What's the best way to access the films?
So the best way would be on my website. However, I figured this was a perfect time of year. I wouldn't be getting much traffic to the website. So it's down right now because I'm redoing it. But the name of the webpage is LincolnPennyFilms.com. And I hope that the 6888 will be up on Amazon Prime within the next week or two. And the Hello Girls is already on Amazon Prime.
That's great. That's great. Good watching for the beginning of the new year, right?
I hope so. I hope so. I think so. Yeah. And you know, if that film comes, if it, the film does come out, I don't know what he said about when it's coming out. There might be a way to dovetail on that. We're not connected to Tyler Perry at all. We are connected a little bit to Blair Underwood
Right.
and that, but we're not connected to Tyler Perry. You know, he writes and directs and
Does his own
produces and
thing, yes.
yeah. That's, I'll be honest with you. That's, I just, I, you know, after 5 years, you know, you kind of really become close to the story and very protective of the story, you know. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a bad review or a bad anything, say anything negative about the women. But you know, when it goes from a documentary to newspaper articles to a feature film by Tyler Perry, I gotta admit, I'm praying every day that, I mean, there's going to be some things and liberties that you have to take, and I understand that, but I hope the core of it is that he you know, he sticks to the story. I understand too, it's ending at Birmingham, so it's not the full story
Okay,
of the
yeah.
6888. Yeah, he's going to get to Birmingham
Well, at least
and part of the States.
it will inspire people to maybe want to learn more.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a nice thing too, is, you know, the next level is, to be honest with you, is figuring out a way to get into appear before. Like I'm going back to Jackson State in April, where I'll be screening the 6888 there. And of course, HBCUs are a big, huge market, I think. Young educated minds, young people need to see women that went, a lot of them went to the school that they're sitting at, you know. I think it's important that the next generation. I just, you know, I always watch the audience And I'll be honest with you, whether it's a 15-year-old who's there with her mom, or 80-year-old man who's there with his wife or by himself, I mean, the reaction to these women is spellbinding. I mean, they're just so shocked that one, they never heard of this story, but there's just something about these women and the way they presented themselves to history via interviews and archival interviews and marching and all this and that. The people, I use this where I overuse it in this case, but the people love them. It's just that simple. They just love them. And they love what they stand for. They love who they are. They love what they became. They love what they did. And now they're recipients, your mom and your family, recipients of one of the highest medals that Congress can give out, if not the highest, Congressional Gold Medal. I mean, that says it all. And those are hard to, Aretha Franklin, when she passed, they immediately submitted her for a Congressional Gold Medal. Hers has not passed yet. And so for enough people to see how important this is pretty special. That's how you know you got something, right? When Congress can act like that. Oops, did I say that live? Right? Did I say that? But they did. They acted. And it's amazing. It's amazing what they've done.
Took a while, but they did, and
They
it's
did.
I'm honored to be a descendant.
Yeah. I'm honored just to be on the outside looking in. I'm honored to have met at one time I was so proud of the six women, even Edna and with Edna and Liz, no longer that way, but I was the only one at one time that had met the six women that I had interviewed in the film. Later on that changed. Yeah, that was a badge of honor for me to say that to all the people on the planet. Dr. J, of all the people on the planet at one point in time, I was the only one that had met all six of the beautiful ladies. So, yeah, that was pretty special. And it has been pretty special. I don't know. You ask what it's like to be in their presence. It's like when you think back on it, is when you're in awe, right? That's when you're like, really? Did I really just sit down with a 102-year-old woman that still drives her car? And they're looking to take my driver's license away, and I'm half her age. Right.
I don't know what you've been doing behind the wheel there, Jim.
I'm telling you, they don't. Yeah. I'm telling you. But yeah, it just all of the above. This is this story. The other two had like 18 months worth of kind of a cycle, if you will, TV, film festivals. Then it kind of peters out. Then you get ones and twosies. The Hello Girls is kind of, I got an interesting email the other day. Carnegie Hall is doing, or a veterans organization that has a platform at Carnegie Hall is going to do something about the Hello Girls. And I ended up putting them in contact with one of the granddaughters of the lead. And they did that same organization did that for the 6888 last year. That's kind of neat to have that type of impact. On these women's history. I think the documentary, the monument piece is that is this beautiful, edifice that's sitting there, these women, these roses amongst all these thorns of men, right at Buffalo Soldiers Park. Did you get that one, Dr. J?
Yes,
I said these beautiful women,
I
these
did hear
roses
too.
of women, all right, amongst these thorns of men like Colin Powell and the Buffalo Soldiers and all the rest, right? They're the only ones there. And that's such a great tribute to them when you go there. But the documentary allowed it to take that whole concept on the road, if you will. Because we even do, we videotape some of the ceremony. But I think the documentary was what was able to propel it. Because once you can see and touch the women, and actually see them and who they are, it becomes special. And yeah, it just took off. My gosh. So,
I haven't been to the monument yet. That's on my list of places to visit in Kansas.
yeah, it's a beautiful park. They're in a beauty where you saw the location they're at.
I did. I did. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really be sitting right over the water, And all the guys, I think, are to the right of them. Well, you look at them, if you're looking at the monument, all the guys are to the left of them, to their right as they're facing this way. So I thought that was kind of poignant too.
Well, I'm waiting. There's some when they install the monument, there's some names missing, and my mother's name was one of the ones who was missing, and so I'm waiting for them to put the additional plaque up, and then I'll
Oh
visit.
my gosh, your mom was one of the names
It's one of the
missing?
names missing. Yep. So they've learned that, and so they're planning to
Oh
do a
my
plaque. But
gosh.
so when that happens, then I'll go visit.
Yeah,
So.
I didn't know that. But your mom's at Arlington. How did they not find her?
I
Who
don't
knows,
know.
right?
Who
Yeah,
knows?
who
Who knows? These
knows?
things happen. So, well, Jim, I want to thank you so much for joining me tonight and discussing this
Yeah.
amazing documentary. This has been an inspiring conversation. I'm so grateful that you joined me tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And you asked about meeting the women. I'll tell you what, it's an honor to meet a descendant of the women, in you and all the ones that we met at the big event in the summer. I mean, that was really something to know that everyone's out there.
Well, we're all looking forward to the actual when we actual the ceremony where we get the gold medal.
I
So
know, right?
I don't know when that'll be, but we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, Ed hasn't given me an update on that. I know they're still working on just the details of what's going to be on the front, what's on the back. It's really, I guess, I think all that's it, all that's left.
So, well, again, thank you so much and happy
Yeah,
holidays
thank you. Happy holidays, everyone.
to my audience. Thank you for listening to Next Us 818 podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like us to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. Since this is our last show in 2022, I want to share some exciting news. We first aired in August of this year. Since that time, our audience has been gradually building. I am pleased to say that beyond the United States, we now have listeners in Greece and India. The age range of our audience is 18 to 60 plus. I am humbled by and appreciative of your interest and support. Looking forward to learning and growing together in 2023. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I'll share a quote about courage from Nelson Mandela. I've learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. I've felt fear more times than I can remember, but I hid it behind a mask of boldness. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear. To that quote, I would note that the women of the 6888 exhibited that boldness and bravery in serving our nation during World War II. See you for our next show on Wednesday, January 4th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Anchor, Spotify, and Google Podcasts.